It's been a little while since I've been up here doing this. I've had this idea in my head a long time, and it's kind of developed over the last couple of months. So I hope I can bring this forth in a way that makes sense without reading too much of it and trying to be conversational. This is not my strong point, but we'll see how it goes. So I'm going to start off by saying the world needs Jesus. And then the second part of that is, am I driving them away? And if so, how? Am I an obstacle to that? Before Jesus returned to heaven, he left us with some instructions. In Matthew 28, it says, go and make disciples of all nations. And in Matthew 5, it says, you are the light of the world. And then one more verse, and this is sort of the verse that is central to my talk here, or the sermon, and which is largely based on, is in 2 Corinthians 5:20. Says, so we are Christ's ambassadors. God is making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. So, Connor, what is an ambassador? Because that's going to come up several times today. Yeah, he goes to foreign countries. And he represents the sending country that he's from. There's a definition here I can read. Generally speaking, an ambassador is a respected official acting as a representative of a nation, or where he comes from, sent to a foreign land or country, like you said. And the ambassador's role is to reflect the official position of the sovereign body that gave him the authority. And when Paul's writing in Corinthians, Paul likens his own calling to that of an ambassador. He is Christ's ambassador, that verse we just read. So we are Christ's ambassadors. God is making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. It's a New Living Translation. That's why it's a little bit different than what you might be used to. So that's kind of to set this up. In the end, we all have a free choice to make to either accept or reject God's calling on our lives. But we as believers do have a big influence in that other person's life and how their view of God is shaped and their view of Christianity is shaped and how they may or may not respond to God's call in their lives. That is definitely a power that God has given us as Christians to have that influence. We are not responsible for their salvation. That is something that everyone has their own responsibility for. But we do have the responsibility to represent God's work in a positive light and to be a good ambassador for him. So I want to be that ambassador and to attract people to Christ. But sometimes I think I might also be an obstacle to that and possibly in extreme cases even be a wall between people and Christ. And why do I say that? I'm not saying I do that regularly. At least I try not to. But I feel like I might have done that before. And so I kind of broke this up into three specific areas where I find that maybe I fall into this trap a little bit, where I can become a little bit of an obstacle between other people and their positive view of Christ. And it's something I want to work on. These are temptations that I have that I can fall into. And you may not experience all three of these. You may experience none of these. But maybe one or two do apply to you and maybe are relevant to you. So yeah, they're kind of areas where I liken our home or our life here on this earth as sort of our embassy. We're sent by God from another world, meaning heaven, and we live in this world in our embassy, which you could say is our house, and we are here as ambassadors. But we can build a wall around our embassy and sort of become an obstacle or maybe become irrelevant or unuseful is not a word, but useless to the role that God has called us. That would be the first step would be useless, and the second more extreme step would be hurtful or an obstacle would be the more extreme example of that. So the three areas that I've identified that I'm going to sort of go over that I fall into sometimes The first one is me, Christ or God and politics. And the second one is me, Christ and other people. And the third one is me, Christ and my kids. And I kind of, those are three things that are relevant to me at this stage in life. And I want to expand on a little bit and see if they apply to you. So the first one is me, Christ, and politics. I love this topic. It's fun for me to talk about. But it can be a temptation that I fall into sometimes. I'm interested in politics. It's something that I've sort of feel like I'm somewhat educated on, certainly not an expert on, but try to read and study up on. And as you may know, I despise anything that reeks of socialism. And it can be very tempting to enter into verbal combat with, mostly it's my customers, is probably the primary target of this. Occasionally with a coworker or something like that, but typically it's with my customers. And most of them are, probably should be an institution. I mean, they're crazy when it comes to this. They really have no idea. They have no common sense. And it can be very tempting to enter into this verbal combat when you sort of have all the logic, all the common sense, all the facts, all the history, everything is on your side. And even though I don't speak very well or maybe not that articulate, it's almost impossible to lose this war of words. And more recently, all the morality, too. That's maybe not always true, but it's a battle that I've often tempted to go into that I feel like I can't lose. And I can sort of make mincemeat of these people that I feel like are wrong. And I'll keep going. I'll get to my point here. So I was debating a customer not that long ago about the New York City's race and the mayor's race in New York City. And I sort of had him talking in a word salad and making no sense and tying himself into actual intellectual knots about if we just take all the guns and tax all the rich and take another COVID booster and whatever else he was trying to say, then everything will be better and the world will be fixed and all this nonsense. And so I was kind of, it can be very fun for me to go into these debates. And I don't always have the correct attitude when I go into them and when I'm engaged in these. And so we're going back and forth, and I even had the idea, I made up a little nickname for this candidate, calling him Moron Commie. I thought that was a pretty clever idea and a pretty clever play on words. And so I walk away from these engagements feeling like I won. I'm sorry that he's a fool, and eventually he'll learn if I just keep telling him the truth. And I don't know, I took his money and I showed him the truth, and I walked away the victor. Or so I thought, anyway. And these are temptations that I have regularly with my customers. So I walk away and I'm kind of thinking, well, what must this guy be thinking? And so I'm thinking, he's probably thinking, wow, that Eric is really smart. I hope I can learn more from him someday. And I wonder what he thinks about Christ's work on the cross and forgiveness for our sins. I should ask him that someday and he'll probably tell me. That's probably what he's thinking. Obviously not, but that's sort of what my imagination would say that he must be thinking after I enlightened him on the New York City's mayor race. And so that's sort of where I fall into this trap sometimes. And I sort of walk away and I stand on my mountain of self-righteous victory as an ambassador for Christ. And how have I fulfilled my calling as an ambassador for Christ and modeled his love to that person? And what have I done to draw him nearer to God and draw him nearer to things of eternal value? And so the answer is, at best, nothing. Yes, I feel good about myself, and I maybe won this little scrimmage, you could call it. But none of the goals that God has put in my life have been accomplished. Ephesians 4:32 says, "Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you." And Romans 2:10 says, "Love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor." And honestly, I did none of those things. I'm not saying that we can never speak political truth to other people and we can't always control how they will react to those things. That is true. But so often for me, these conversations 10 seconds in turn from speaking truth to a verbal beatdown where the only objective is to crush my opponent. And I sort of lost the objective of speaking truth, and the goal is just to win something or to win an argument and feel good about myself and walk away feeling good about myself. But I can speak truth in God's correct time, which is often not as frequent as I would like it to be. But if the goal of the conversation has moved from being an ambassador for Christ to winning a victory, then I've really completely lost track of God's calling in my life to be an ambassador for Christ. Then two other experiences I've kind of had in this area. I can think of two people I've known for a long time in my life. One of them is very similar in viewpoints to me, and the other is completely different, has no viewpoints like I do. But the person who's completely different to me has always treated me well, has treated me kind. I've gotten along well with that person. And the person that is similar to me in their worldview has mistreated me at times. And I look back, like, who am I more likely to want to be around, to perhaps even take advice from, and to respect and honor? And the obvious answer is the person that's nothing like me and has no viewpoints like I do. So kindness can open doors for influence, even when you might have nothing else in common with that person. And that's what I've experienced in that area. And so I suspect that it's true the other way around, too. But an unguarded tongue can close hearts forever. Then I guess one final thought on this section is Colossians 4:6. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. For better or for worse, in this era that we live in, probably for worse, a lot of our interactions are done through screens now. It's just the way it is. I don't see it changing a lot, but it is a reality. And I've noticed that a lot of people can be especially vicious when debating these topics when it's done through a screen, because somehow we assume that that person on the other side of that keyboard is not a human. Now, I know in this age of AI that is possible, but more than likely these interactions typically happen with people that we know a little bit, but not maybe see every day. And that's where I've noticed this a lot, is there's an extra measure of viciousness oftentimes when we're interacting with people on the other side of the keyboard, because somehow God didn't create them and these verses don't apply because there's a screen in between us. And that's unfortunately not true. So keep that in mind as we are often... We find ourselves being Christ's ambassadors through a screen and through a keyboard. Not all of us, but for a lot of us, this will come up at some point in our lives. And to remember this verse, not only in person-to-person interactions, but also in our electronic interactions. So me, Christ, and other people, moving on to the second point here on this. This is something that's a little more recent for me. The temptation to fall into political combat has been a long time for me. I have been tempted that for years and years. This one is newer. And that's the temptation to live an isolated life. As we get older, and I'm getting older now, I know I have less energy. Some of you may have experienced that. You need more rest. Things take you a little longer. And I can remember when I was little and we had to do Sunday afternoon naps, and I despised them. Oh, I hated them. I dreaded Sundays. And now as I'm older, all I want to do is nap on Sunday afternoons. I would be perfectly content to go home every Sunday and just sleep and nap and be by myself. And so it's something that's a little more recent, but now my kids despise Sunday afternoon naps. But what I'm getting at is the temptation to live an isolated life. And I'm not saying we should run ourselves into exhaustion, but there can be sort of this temptation to retreat into our own castle and say that other people are just so messed up, it's not worth it. I don't have the energy or the willpower or the desire to deal with it. I'm just going to stay in my house here and serve the Lord here and pray and wait for his return. And that'll be that. And in this era of wealth that we live in, most of us have a house, we have healthcare, we have retirement, we have health insurance, we have savings, we have a car, we have whatever entertainment we have in our house that we choose to, and we basically could do that. We can live a very isolated life if we so choose, and basically block out the rest of God's creation and do our thing and wait for his return. But then the question becomes, can an ambassador do the sending nations work if he sits on his couch in his embassy till he is recalled home? I think the obvious answer is no. A role of an ambassador is to be out and to interact with the country that he is visiting and to put forth a good image of his sending nation. And if he just buries himself in his embassy waiting to be called back, he's kind of squandered that gift, the ability to influence others for Christ and to encourage those already in the body. That gift is sort of wasted and squandered at that point, because he can't do that if he's just buried in his embassy. And Thessalonians 5:11 says, therefore, encourage one another and build one another up just as you are doing. And Galatians 6:2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And I think these two verses are impossible to live out, living an isolated life and hiding in that embassy and just waiting for God. And reminds me kind of the servant who buried the treasure. I forget the passage exactly, but where the master goes away and the servant is given a share of the treasure and he just buries it and says, it's not really worth it. I don't want to mess it up. I'm just going to kind of hide it and bury it and wait for my master's return. And that's not how God wants us to live. The verses I just read, I think, make that pretty clear. And our ability to help others and be an influence and example is basically zero at that point. And then the second part to that is we need these things just as much as others do. An ambassador will regularly return to his home country for debriefing, guidance, new instructions, and correction or encouragement. We must not forsake the gathering together. Hebrews 10:24 and 25 says, let us consider how to stir up one another in love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another and all the more as you see the day drawing near. I think we need the same thing that we can provide to other people. God never meant for us to walk this road alone. We need this encouragement, this guidance, this correction, all these things that come together with the gathering of the saints. And then final note on this is retreating into isolation has the potential to cause aimless drifting of our faith. I haven't really experienced this, but I have observed it occasionally where we kind of get into a rut where we question everything but really believe nothing. We don't even realize sometimes the road we're on because we're so isolated and we've kind of lost the ability to have godly counsel around us. There's no one around us to act as a check and balance for this slow fade of our faith, perhaps, and we don't even realize it because the process is so slow. But we've isolated ourselves so much that we don't even realize the road we're on, and it's a shame. It's not necessary, and I think a lot of it can be avoided if we simply do not neglect the gathering of the saints. Then finally, me, Christ, and my kids. This is a new topic for me. I've actually never spoken on anything related to my kids. I don't claim to have all the wisdom and knowledge on this. If there's other ideas on this, please bring it forth in the sharing time. I don't claim to be the final word on raising children. But when we are ambassadors for Christ, we are called. And when we are called home, when we die, we all will, I think we can all agree that we will take nothing with us. I think that's generally pretty well understood. There's no luggage rack on our tombstone. And yeah, we came with nothing and we will return with nothing. Now, I did hear, I think Mr. Hurst or Uncle Bruce both said this once, that the only thing we can take with us is the souls of our kids. And it's not entirely true, because every person is ultimately responsible for their salvation. But I think the point they were trying to make is that we as parents have the greatest influence over our kids. Let me reword that. There's no one else we have more influence on than our children. We spend, obviously, a lot of time with them in the early years, and we are the primary shaper and builder of our kids' character, and ultimately their view of Christ is largely shaped on what we teach them and how we present that. So it's something we have a very big influence on. So with great power comes great responsibility. It's not in the Bible. I think that's a little Spider-Man wisdom, but it's true nonetheless. And we have the opportunity to model Christ's love to them and lead them on a straight and narrow teaching, and teaching them God's commands. But because of this power we have, we also have the opportunity to become an obstacle to our kids' faith. And I'll kind of expand on that a little bit. In Proverbs 22:6, that's probably a pretty familiar verse, says, "Train up a child when he is young, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it." So I've kind of been thinking about that verse a lot lately. Like I said, it's something I've never talked about, but I've been thinking about that verse. And I'm kind of in the halfway point in my child raising, maybe not quite halfway, but my oldest son is about halfway through it. And so I'm basing this partly on what I've experienced and partly what I've observed in other families. But I used to think that training up a child when he was young, like maybe 18 or 19, and when he's old, like 37 or 38, I don't know, he will remember what he was taught and not depart from it. And I think that was probably not a correct interpretation of that verse and not the way it was meant to be applied. And as I've gone through the early years of child training, I've come to see that the verse is much more applicable if we understand it in a way to say to train up a child when he is young, meaning 1 or 2 or 3, and when he is old, like 10 or 11, he will not depart from that. I think that understanding of it is much more relevant and much more applicable, and I believe to be the correct interpretation of that verse. So how can we become an obstacle to our children's faith? As fathers and head of the home, these early years can be frustrating and tiring. We can be tempted to say, "Oh, these little temper tantrums are no big deal," or "I'm too tired to deal with this screaming kid right now. Just let him watch something, or give him a toy, or give him some food, or whatever. I don't really want to deal with it, and I don't have the energy, and I just corrected him on this 10 minutes ago. Whatever, just put him outside. It'll be fine. He'll grow out of it." That can be the attitude of parents sometimes, because it is tiring. It requires consistency and energy that never seems to end. It's ongoing, and you're never really done, it feels like. And I know God has appointed me as head of the home, and I think I sort of have an understanding of what my role is, but I also have a 2-year-old who would have me believe that he is the head of the home. And like I mentioned earlier, there's a fair amount of resources and energy going to remind him that he's not. And there's very frequent meetings between the seat of knowledge and the board of education. Is that how you say it? And sometimes these meetings are less than 5 minutes apart. And that's just the way it is with a 2-year-old. And now, fortunately, at that age, the misdemeanors are often not very severe. The child is very young, and the discipline needed is often very mild, too. It is at an early stage, and he's sort of testing things out, testing what he can get away with. But it can be very frequent. It can be very repetitive and therefore very tiring. And it's something we can be tempted to let go or neglect. But there is sort of a penalty for that. If these early years of child training are neglected, you'll often see very poor character qualities exhibited in that child later in life, from an undisciplined and selfishness to self-centered attitudes, very immature behavior. These things will inevitably be something that kids will fall into if they're not trained early in life. And so what happens then, as the child grows, the parents feel like they're sort of trapped and they have to sort of force this child into compliance later in life, say, you know, 10, 12, whatever, when he's a little bit older, and force him into obedience. And at this point, the misdemeanors have become more severe, and parents feel like the corrective action they need to take is also more severe at this point. And it can be sort of a frustrating trend where the stakes grow higher and higher, and the verbal altercations get louder and louder and can spill into violence in extreme cases. But with what started with good intentions can end in tragedy sometimes as we try to force a child to do our will. And I see this sometimes in other families. Fortunately, I have not personally experienced this, but I always find it very sad when parents feel the need to scream and curse and yell at their kids, and something that's very hard to watch. But having a two-year-old, I understand the motivation behind it. It's something I'm tempted to do sometimes. But it will never achieve the objective, which is they're trying to... It's a good objective. The objective is for the child to obey and to learn. But that will never be achieved that way. Now, we might be able to physically overpower a kid and crush this rebellious spirit for a few years as they grow older, but it is a hollow victory. So much like the first point I made with the politics, parents can walk away from these altercations with their children feeling like, I won. You know, it was a terrible fight, but I was able to force this kid to do what I want or get him to see my point. And so I did it right as a parent because I won that altercation, and now he will learn. I say he because I have boys, but it could be a girl or a boy. It doesn't really matter. But what did we really win? Just like my first example, it sort of is a hollow victory. And this is where I think we can become an obstacle to our children's faith as these things escalate and bitterness will grow on both sides, but especially on the children's side. And there will be a tendency for them to reject anything that we teach or promote or try to instill in them simply because they don't want to receive this training that we are trying to force on them later in life. And it sort of has the net effect of them resenting everything we are trying to instill in them. Whereas if we had not neglected those early years of training, which can be very tiring, I will concede that, and very monotonous, and seems like we're not getting anywhere sometimes. But if those early years are not neglected, I think there can be a much quicker transition, and there needs to be that transition, much younger than I realized, say by 9 or 10, to where a parent fills that role of, I don't want to say partnership, but is going through life with that child, acting as a mentor, acting as a counselor, a guide, with correction, but it's not a relationship where the parent is the ruler and the hammer. And that transition needs to happen at some point. Now, with a two-year-old, yes, there's really one skill they need to learn, and that is obedience at all times, no matter what. And most two-year-olds will never fully learn that. None will, actually. But that is the objective that we should work towards. But pretty quickly, that does need to transition to guidance and correction. And this requires, well, yeah, okay, let me finish that up. So, but if we don't do that, I wanted to read one more verse here. So in Colossians 3:21, fathers, do not embitter your children or they will become discouraged. And I think if we neglect those early years and try to then catch up for that in later years, we have the potential to embitter our children and through that drive them away from the very thing that we are trying to teach them. And we are in a much better position to teach them later in life if we don't neglect that. And one thing we don't lose later in life is the example that we can set. Older kids may not want to receive guidance or, well, I should say, orders from their parents. They may resent that, but they will look to their parents as role models and examples. They may not admit it, and they may not even do it consciously, but there will be, we still have that ability to be an influence over them through the example that we are. It can be subtle, but it's definitely still there. So we never really lose that ability. And then kind of the final thought on this is, as this transition happens and there is a transition in how we raise our kids and it becomes more of a mentorship and an example and a coach and a guidance and correction rather than a ruler relationship, it does sometimes require us to surrender the goals that we might have for our kids. Sometimes parents can further embitter their kids. And the verse says fathers, because I think fathers are especially prone to this, where we have some kind of life goal or plan for our kids, that they be good at sports or that they go to this college or that they follow this career path. And they have good intentions with this often, but it is something that we will do need to surrender as fathers a little bit, and that we can't use our kids to serve our own plans. There needs to be a letting go as they get older, and allow them, with guidance, with correction, and through our example, but allow them to make some choices as they get older and not try to dictate and control exactly what directions they pursue. And this letting go part is not something I have experienced a lot yet, but I had a very small experience in this a little while back where Connor likes to play board games. And so I don't know if this is directly applicable, but I felt like I had to check myself in this area a little bit because I'm typically able to crush him in any board game that we have in our house. But Stratego has been an outlier for some reason, and he has on multiple times been able to beat me at that game. And I often, it seems incredible, but I feel like I'm a little bit resentful over that because, like, who does this guy think he is that... He is beating the head of the house in this game. And so it's something I've had to maybe repent from a little bit, but realize that there needs to be a letting go and a realization that he's not somebody that is going to be under my direct control. And it's something that I need to... there's a transition point where I need to now be a coach and a guide rather than a ruler, because I don't want to risk embittering my child. But yeah, just get rid of the game, throw them out. Only games that I can win from now on. So I don't know if it's a good example, but it's something where I've felt this resentful spirit a little bit, where I feel like I need to make sure that this child is always under my control, because if he beats me at this game, then we can't do this anymore. And it's something I want to repent from. Because that's an area where I feel like I run the risk of embittering him, because I feel like I have to have him under my thumb all the time, and I don't want that to be the case. So if you have kids of that age, I hope these things are applicable. And if you are an older child on the receiving end of that, perhaps you can understand a little bit then where your parents are coming from. Perhaps some of these things were done well, perhaps they weren't. Not everyone is able to fully live these things out, myself included. But if you are a child, perhaps later in life, out of the house, but look back, understand maybe the objective of your parents, even though it wasn't brought forth perfectly. But realize that no matter how your parents did it, we as children still have a duty to honor our parents. That is a commandment that God gives us in the Bible. And there's no conditions given with that commandment. It just says honor your father and mother. It doesn't say honor them if they don't embitter you, or honor them if they let you beat them in board games. It just says honor your parents. So that's something that we are called to no matter what. But perhaps seeing it from this perspective will give you a little more insight into that. And then if you are someone with young kids, which was where I'm at, don't neglect those early years of training, because I think the temptation is to let it go and to go the easy way. But we will definitely run the risk of being an obstacle to our children's faith if we neglect those early years and then feel like we need to force them in the later years of life. So that's what I have today. Thank you, guys. If you guys have any testimonies, especially on the last topic that I shared, that was the harder one of the three for me to kind of make sense of, but definitely bring it forth.